I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Syrian government forces and rebels have been fighting in Aleppo for several weeks. The city is the largest in Syria, a major commercial center, and rather close to the Turkish border. The conflict in Syria, which began a year and a half ago with a protest against the government of Bashar al-Assad, has claimed thousands of lives. Syria's prime minister defected last week and has reportedly arrived in neighboring Jordan. The U.S. and the EU have placed sanctions on Syria, while China, Russia, and Iran continue to stand with the government. Today on Radio Times, we get an update on the crisis in Syria and its impact on the region. We'll also be talking about the challenges all of this poses to the international community. And we have two guests. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Samer Aboud. He's an assistant professor of international studies at Arcadia University, just outside of Philadelphia. He's also a fellow in the at the Center for Syrian Studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And Samer Aboud, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And on the telephone and joining us from Ireland is Stephen Starr. He's a journalist who spent the last 5 years living in Syria. He's the author of a new book called Revolt in Syria, Eyewitness to the Uprising. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of Near East Quarterly. And Stephen Starr, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Samer, let me begin with you and even begin with what's going on in Aleppo today. What's the significance of the fighting in that city?
Well, the uprising began in the peripheries of the cities in the rural areas. And at that point, the regime was able to say that it was, you know, these small pockets of protesters that were foreign-led. I remember at the time that the regime and its supporters were saying, look, all of these protests are happening at the borders, so they're being fed by regional actors. Slowly and gradually, the protests have spread to the cities. And the cities, Damascus and Aleppo, are where the regime has its most control at this moment. So the fighting in Damascus, the fighting in Aleppo, is slowly further undermining the regime's control, not only of the cities, but of the country at large.
Stephen Starr, the same question to you. What do you see as the significance of the fighting in Aleppo?
It is very significant. I think we're actually hearing this morning, at least, that in several parts of certain districts of the city, the rebels have been beaten back by regime forces, which kind of follows a line of events that have taken place also in Damascus last month. Rebels were able to hold ground in certain parts of the city for a couple of days. In Homs back in February, rebels were able to hold an area for about a month before they were beaten back. So we're definitely seeing a pattern kind of emerging here where rebels go into residential areas of major cities, try to keep control of these areas, but are kind of, you know, eventually beaten back by the regime's forces.
Is that because the regime has more firepower, Stephen?
Basically so, yeah. I mean, they're using MiGs and kind of warplanes and helicopters and so on, as well as they're shelling these areas as well. And, you know, this Free Syrian Army has no answer to this. They have some RPGs, I guess, and they have machine guns and so on. But, you know, it's incomparable in terms of a military fight, and they just can't hold on to this territory.
Samer, are we talking about a civil war in Syria?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, it was declared recently by the Red Cross that Syria had entered a civil war, but I think you could have spoken of a civil war much before then, especially when you saw a gradual proliferation of armed rebel groups, you know, fighting very loosely under this, you know, the command of the Free Syrian Army. The regime itself, its army, is slowly turning into a militia, right? It's no longer a national army that is aimed at protecting its citizens, but it's an armed group that is protecting the regime and the party. It's no longer contributing to any kind of security of the country. And I think that Syria's descent into civil war happened much before we started calling it a civil war.
Well, Stephen, let me go back to you because you were living in Syria. Did you see the beginnings of this civil war, the roots of the cause of this civil war?
Well, I think it's very much a localized conflict. I mean, I lived in a town about 10 miles, I suppose, outside Damascus, where things are relatively calm, and I entered the city, Damascus, the capital, most days, I guess. And life there kind of continued much as normal, aside from the fact that people had less access to electricity and goods and services became more expensive and so on. You know, from the point of the major cities, at least until quite recently, life was quite normal. At the same time, you travel a couple of kilometers outside the city center to the eastern suburbs. They have been shelled by regime forces, and life of people living there is very different indeed. And a lot of people, I think, are, you know, places that are not directly affected by the regime's violence are a little bit maybe sick up, fed up of the revolution and what comes with it. There's certainly a revolt fatigue appearing from when I talk to some people in Damascus and other parts of the country at the moment.
Well, and going back to you, Samer, we were talking about the Arab Spring, the various uprisings that we've seen in countries in the Middle East. How is what's happening in Syria different or similar?
Well, it's different in the sense that the army in Tunisia and Egypt slowly withdrew its support from the political leadership. In Syria, that wasn't the case. I mean, quite the opposite, is that you had a kind of consolidation of the power of the regime, the privileging, if you will, of the security and the military apparatus and their solution to this problem, of course. And for the most part, after 17 months, the regime has remained somewhat cohesive. There have, of course, been a number of defections, but that has just consolidated the power of a very small group of military and security officials, and, of course, the fighters on the ground that are loyal to them. It's different from Tunisia and Egypt in that sense, but it's similar to Libya in the sense that you do have these kind of pockets of fighting that are occurring against regime forces that are slowly and gradually creeping into the regime's main bases. You have obviously defections on a daily basis. First, it was mostly conscripts that were defecting, but now you have regular soldiers that are defecting, officers, generals, colonels. Slowly, that kind of military basis of the regime is withering away. And I think that's very similar to what happened in Libya.
Stephen, let me quote something that you write in your book. Generalizations have been sweeping in the international and national debate on the Syrian uprising. Some Alawites, I know, are fervently anti-regime. Some Sunnis would die for the president.
Yeah, I think we need to be, you know, a little bit wiser in how we're reporting of what's happening. It's very dangerous to make these broad statements and, you know, saying that all Alawis support the regime and that all Sunnis want the fall of the current government. It's much more complicated than that, obviously. You know, lots of people, in the main cities, are living, or until recently at least, were living quite comfortable lives. And they had good jobs and they had stability and so on, and they had decent salaries, I guess. And, I mean, you know, they might not have liked the regime very much, but they valued the stability and income every month more than freedom, I guess. So, you know, we need to be more nuanced in how we're reporting what's happening. And to say that all Christians support the regime or to say that all Christians are afraid is not true either. So, you know, it's very dangerous, I think, to make these broad brushstrokes claiming that it's sectarian. Now, unfortunately, the majority of Alawis want the regime to stay, and the majority of Christians similarly want, you know, the same thing. But to say that they all are is just wrong.
Well, I wonder. Even go ahead, Samer. Looks like you want to say something.
Well, I would. I completely agree with Stephen's assessment there. I think Syria is a very complicated place. It's a very diverse place, and its politics are not as cut and dry as we'd like to see them. You know, it's not pro regime, pro opposition. But one thing that I would add to that, and which is I think driving some people into the more pro regime camp, whether they're Sunni or Christian or Alawi or whatever, is that there's a very real fear of the destruction of the country itself, not just the regime. The regime can collapse, the regime can come and go, but people are genuinely, I think, concerned about something akin to Iraq or something akin to what happened in Lebanon. I mean, Syrians, of course, are very aware of what happened to their neighbors. They're very aware of what happened to Lebanon a generation ago during its very bloody civil war. And I think that that is something that is driving a lot of anxiety, if you will, among many Syrians, is that they might be happy to see the regime go, but what they don't want to see is their country completely collapse.
Well, there are some reports, and I realize one has to be careful about reports coming out of Syria, but Samer, there are reports of jihadis who have come into, or jihadists who have come into Syria, maybe even fighting alongside the rebels or fighting their own battles within that country.
Certainly. I think there was even... 2 days ago, there was a report that members of the Free Syrian Army had actually admitted that some of the jihadis had infiltrated their ranks. There's also jihadis that are working independently, and there's also jihadists that are probably waiting to come in, to come into the country. I think that is extremely problematic when you have, again, a proliferation of armed groups that are not unified any under any central command, and this just expands the nature of the violence, expands the nature of the conflict, and it does make anyone, Sunni, Alawi, Christian, whatever, who is concerned about perhaps a future Syrian government being dominated by Islamists, it makes them weary of supporting the opposition or, you know, expressing anti-regime sentiments.
Stephen, do you know why these jihadis are there?
They're there because they see an opportunity to kind of create their own, put their own kind of feet on the ground and try and get some control of this country in the Middle East. They've failed elsewhere, as we've seen. And they obviously are attracted to the violence and this kind of instability that's gripped the country. I mean, Syria has for decades been this very, very structured state where security was extremely tight. And now you're seeing this very rapid breakdown in the regime's kind of control and the state's influence over people's lives and that. So there's this huge gap, and it's particularly pertinent, I think, for Syria because you've had this kind of huge kind of change for people's lives. Before the revolution started, people knew exactly what they could say, what they could do. Mm-hmm. They knew exactly what they could not talk about. And, there was this structure in place. And now, since the regime is crumbling and has been for a while, there's space for jihadis and other unsavory elements to enter the country. And we all know that Syria is a very, very important country geopolitically and strategically in the region. So they would take advantage, in any which way they can, and they understand that it's a divided country and that, lots of people support the regime and lots of people, obviously, are behind the revolution. And they will work to kind of, see what they can do and claim their best interests out of all the mess.
We're almost having a break here, but you also have said, Stephen Starr, that there's a silent majority that doesn't back the regime or the rebels.
For sure, yeah. I mean, there's millions and millions of people, particularly who have not been affected by the violence and who live in the major cities. Now, it's decreasing now over the last couple of weeks since we've seen battles in the major cities. They just want a peaceful life. They don't particularly, they're maybe afraid of the revolution. They don't like the regime. They know what it's capable of. They know that it's violent and that if you say the wrong thing in a public place, you can end up in prison for the rest of your days.
Hold on to that thought only because we are up on our very short break, and that is Stephen Starr. He's a journalist who has spent the last 5 years living in Syria, also with his Samer Aboud from Arcadia University. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Much more.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
I'm Jordan Morris. The influential punk band Red Cross was started in the late 70s by two brothers, neither of which were even old enough to drive. Their first gig was an opening slot for Black Flag, but the show wasn't in a punk club.
Eighth grade graduation party, so they expected you to play a Foghat cover, and we played Who Are the Mystery Girls?
A New York Dolls cover. Red Cross, this week on Bullseye, from PRI.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
The documentary The Barber of Birmingham looks at the role James Armstrong played in the civil rights movement and why he put his life and business on the line.
I always thought when I was growing up, the worst thing a man can do is nothing. I got a lot of pictures of everybody in here that was doing something.
We find out more about the Barber of Birmingham next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the crisis, the conflict in Syria. Let me reintroduce our guest, Samer Aboud, with us here in our Philadelphia studios. He's an assistant professor of international studies at Arcadia University. On the telephone, Stephen Starr, journalist who spent the last 5 years living in Syria, left that country earlier this year, author of a new book called Revolt in Syria, Eyewitness to the Uprising. He's also the founder and editor in chief of Near East Quarterly. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions, do give us a call. Stephen, I had to interrupt you. Do you remember what you were saying right before the break?
Yeah, basically there are quite a few people, we're talking millions of Syrians, who don't like the revolution. They know that the regime is brutal. And they basically don't see any positive conclusion to the current situation in the country. They're very put out by what's happening, and they associate the revolution with all these ills in their everyday lives. They know that that Syrian media is not telling the truth. They know, on the other hand, that Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, which are two region-wide TV stations, also have their agendas, as they are supported and backed by the Qatari government and the Saudi Arabian government, and they have their own agendas in Syria too. So, you know, people are sick of, I mean, they don't want to turn on TV to watch the news. They don't have electricity, so they can't put their ACs on. And, you know, you're talking it's 100 degrees of heat there at the moment. People are fasting. It's the month of Ramadan. And, you know, they associate all these ills with the revolution. And I think a lot of people, if they could, they would like the country, or at least their circumstances, to go back to the way things were before the revolution. But, of course, that's an impossibility now.
Right. Well, and just to underscore something you just said, Stephen, you also say, or have said, that these videos that we see, these YouTube videos that come in from Syria, that we should be, some of them are horrifying, that we should be careful what we are looking at.
For sure, exactly. I mean, I guess the vast majority of them are, you know, from Syria, and that we don't know when and we don't know where, and they can be doctored and changed by activists when and how they please. So we need, you know, as we say, we need to be very careful about what's reported, and the fact that a video is played on a particular television station and says that these images cannot be verified. I mean, that doesn't kind of work very well, I guess, with audiences who see these shocking images. This disclaimer is kind of forgotten when people see these awful images.
Let me go back to you, Summer, and help us understand, I guess, the revolution. I asked you this earlier, but it's... Is there leadership? Is there someone that members of these rebel groups turn to or hear messages from?
I think there's a complete absence of a kind of hierarchical leadership within the country. We also have to distinguish between the inside opposition and the outside opposition. Outside of the country, there are now multiple opposition groups. The one we're probably most familiar with is the Syrian National Council, but you have a number of other groups that have formed in recent months, and actually within the last couple of days, there's been the declaration of something like two or three transitional governments in Syria that are completely led by opposition, by outside opposition groups. And then there's, of course, the opposition that's on the ground. The protest began as a predominantly, almost purely non-violent series of protests, and out of that emerged the local coordination committees that attempted not necessarily to lead the protests, but to act as a kind of clearinghouse of information, if you will, and to help coordinate some of the protests. So from the beginning, it was decentralized and non-hierarchical. And the same thing has actually, interestingly, occurred in the violent protests, the kind of more militarized version of the protests, that, you know, we can't really speak of a coordinated hierarchical Free Syrian Army. It's a bunch of people operating under... with this very loose loyalty to the Free Syrian Army, claiming you know, again, claiming this loose loyalty, that are engaging in acts of violence. And I think Stephen points to something that is very real and very objective for many Syrians, and that's that the opposition, the militarized opposition, is engaging in violence against civilians. Mm. There are multiple reports, whether they're true or not. Many people within Syria are hearing stories of the armed opposition targeting civilians, targeting minorities. You know, from what I gather, many Syrians are talking about now the thugs of the regime and the thugs of the opposition. So there is no centralized command. The opposition, both inside and outside, is extremely fragmented. And I think this makes the kind of rush to overthrowing the regime extremely problematic. But then it also makes establishing authority after the fact equally, if not more, problematic and difficult.
Stephen, would it be fair to say that the opposition is united in that it wants to get rid of the regime of Bashar al-Assad?
Yeah, it's true, but it's probably the only thing that unites them. There's no agreement on how it can and should be done. And of course, you know, there are two kind of separate elements. There's the political opposition, who mostly live outside the country, and you know, they've been exiled from Syria for many years in some cases. They have very little faith. The people on the ground have very little faith in these these opposition leaders, simply because they're kind of, you know, they're sitting in safety and comfort in Cairo or in Istanbul. They're appearing on kind of TV stations every night and denouncing the regime and so on, but they're not experiencing this revolution, and, you know, they don't feel the pain of the people, essentially. And on the other hand, you've got the military opposition, which are the rebels. And as Samir was saying, they're extremely kind of disjointed and that, which I guess to an extent it works in that, you know, rebel forces can move as they like and kind of use guerrilla tactics against the regime. That works in the short term, but in terms of building a new Syrian army, or in terms of actually uniting in order to try and take a major city, you know, that coordination doesn't exist very much. So it's an extremely complicated kind of situation, both in terms of the political opposition and the military opposition on the ground.
Stephen, let me ask you about some of these defections. I guess the most high-level defection was the prime minister last week. He apparently is in Jordan now. What is the significance of that, if anything?
I mean, it's important, but I don't think it's going to change things that much on the ground. I think we need to be clear and differentiate between two issues as well. I mean, you have the regime, the Syrian regime, which consists of military and security issues, and you have the government, which are all the ministries, the ministers who lead them, you know, people who are appointed on every couple of years or every, you know, whenever the regime seems it to be important to change ministerial positions. You know, people in the government have very little power, essentially. It's the people in the regime, it's the Assad family, it's the people around the regime, the people who control the military and the security apparatus. They are the people with the real power. So, you know, the fact that this prime minister defected, it's moral boosting to an extent, but in terms of actually changing things on the ground, it's not going to do that. You know, we should be much more focused on what's happening in Aleppo in terms of the military battles there. That, you know, what's happening there has the potential to change the direction of the revolution. But not, we'll say, the defection of the prime minister.
Summer, what have been the effects of the sanctions, which have been in place for some time now and been added to, I guess, more recently?
Yeah, the effect of the sanctions has actually been quite profound, to be honest. Recently, I think an oil minister came out and said that the effect of the EU sanctions on oil was about $4 billion on the Syrian budget. And so what the sanctions did effectively was try and isolate the reserves of the Syrian commercial bank. They were able to actually move those reserves into Russia and repatriate some of the reserves. So the reserves were available to the commercial bank after. But the biggest impact was in the oil sanctions. And now there are refineries in China and India, for example, who receive Syrian oil, but they can't find anyone to insure their ships.
Oh, wow.
So they're sitting on a lot of oil. They're not able to ship it. I mean, they're essentially bankrupt. They're on the verge of bankruptcy.
This is the Syrian government.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have the revenues to marshal towards subsidies, towards like basic governance expenses, and this is where you see the microeconomy of the country collapsing because of the pressure on the macroeconomy. So initially, the government was able to marshal some of those reserves and funnel it into the economy to support, prices were going very high, the Syrian dollar, I mean, inflation was very high, so they could pump money into the economy to bring those prices down and to make it slightly more affordable for people. But eventually, the black market just took over, and the black market dominates now, and average prices are beyond the means of average Syrians. And as the crisis progresses, the government simply doesn't have the resources to bring those prices down or, you know, to increase salaries or to do anything of that nature to stabilize the economy.
But is there any way to know whether these sanctions have destabilized the government, the regime?
They've destabilized them in the sense that they've had an impact on the regime's ability to govern. Now, you know, we've been saying for the last 20 minutes or so that it's engaging in a very brutal military solution to the crisis, but you know, it's still a government that has to govern. I mean, it has to pick up the garbage, it has to pay salaries, it has to do things of that nature. And in the absence of revenues, it becomes very difficult to perform those basic governance tasks. 20-25% of employed Syrians are in the public sector. Those salaries have to be paid out of the government budget, and as that bleeds more and more, it becomes increasingly difficult for the government to do even that.
And that's Samer Aboud, our guest here in our Philadelphia studios, assistant professor of international studies at Arcadia University, and by telephone, Stephen Starr joining us from Ireland. He was until recently a journalist who spent the last 5 years living in Syria, has written a book called Revolt in Syria, Eyewitness to the Uprising. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of Near East Quarterly. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions about Syria or perhaps even what the U.S., the international community, should or shouldn't do, give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stephen, since you lived in Syria for 5 years, did you see the effects of the sanctions close up?
Yeah, for sure you could. I mean, it's becoming extremely difficult to get gas for people's cars. And one stage last February, I spent half a day driving from gas station to gas station looking for gas for my car. And, you know, the same thing has happened. It's happening millions of people all over the country, and not just Damascus. In Aleppo, I think at the moment it's particularly bad, a shortage of gas. People can't travel around and they can't get to work. They can't buy food. And they can't escape the fighting because they don't have fuel for their cars. So in that respect, the sanctions have made a huge kind of change to people's lives. But from what I know, as Simon was saying, the public sector in Syria is very big, and people are still being paid at the beginning of every month. So as long as the government is able to pay the salaries of these millions of people in the public sector, it keeps things a semblance of normality in the major cities. That continues. I think once the government is unable to pay these public sector salaries, you're going to see things change very rapidly in terms of humanitarian issues, and certainly a crisis is looming in that regard in the major cities.
You left Syria, Stephen, this spring. Was there an incident or a reason that you left the country?
Yeah, I mean, I visited an area in eastern Damascus that had recently been recaptured by regime forces. A couple of days before I visited, you had this number of very large demonstrations, and the demonstrators were being protected by the Free Army. And the regime moved in and wiped out the army, the rebels, who fled the area. Now, obviously, the civilians in the area couldn't leave. They had nowhere to go, and they ended up, feeling the brunt of what was happening. Their houses were destroyed, and their families, their men and women, were killed. So in order to get to this area and report on what was happening, we had to pass through, I think, four or five checkpoints on the way in and four or five checkpoints on the way out. I traveled there with a couple of English journalists who left the country the following afternoon on a plane back to London. But for me, I was still kind of there. I was still in the city, and I became more kind of paranoid, having stayed there and having seen what I'd seen in this eastern suburb, which included a number of dead people and that. So, I think, as I say, paranoia kind of grew in a sense. And, I mean, if I was sitting, for example, in my apartment and you could hear steps outside on the stairs, you'd kind of stop my work and kind of, you know, wonder if someone coming to check on me and that. And, you know, for a finish, it became a very uncomfortable kind of life to be living.
Were you ever directly, overtly threatened?
No, I was never directly threatened, but on a number of occasions, security officials came to my house to, you know, kind of check on me and so on. I mean, they would ask very kind of benign, kind of very ancillary questions as to what my, you know, my background and so on. I think the point was to come to my house and kind of, you know, kind of let me know that they know that they can get me when they want, or they have access to me as and when they wish. But no, I was never directly threatened.
Stephen, I have to say, as you were describing that, Summer has a kind of knowing look, a knowing nod, smiling as you're describing it. Go ahead, Summer.
When I was living in Damascus, I went multiple times between 2003 and 2010, and I had very similar visits, and I had someone visit me at the taxi stand when I was going to go to I was waiting for a taxi to go to Lebanon, and he kept offering to take me, and had just told me about all the things that I was already doing in Syria, and I don't think I was important enough to be watched, but I certainly think that when you're there on a research permit and you have that kind of permit as I was, it certainly raises somebody's eyebrow. But it's certainly something that many people who are not Syrian who go there, as Stephen suggested, have to experience. But of course, life is much, much worse for the Syrians, and the kind of fear that they live under is worse than anything that we've experienced.
Indeed. Yeah. Stephen, there's so many moving parts and so many things that can happen, but I'm just wondering, how do you think this is going to end?
Well, it's going to end with the fall of the regime. There's no other way for things to finish. The question is when and how many people are going to die in the interim period. And I think many people have been surprised, including myself at least, at how long and how much strength the regime is able to enforce kind of on rebels. You know, when the revolution started in March 2011, I was certainly thinking that, you know, the revolution would succeed by, you know, the fall kind of 6 months later. You know, we're almost 18 months in at this stage, and the regime is still quite strong. And it seems to be kind of moving towards a stalemate, and I think what's happening in Aleppo kind of, I don't know, kind of illustrates a larger kind of situation of what's happening in Syria. The regime is not able to keep control of many parts of the country, but nor are rebels able to do the similarly in kind of built-up urban areas. And you kind of have this kind of state of flux between, you know, rebels will take control of an area, the regime comes in, the rebels flee, and then the regime leaves, you know, their army goes somewhere else to fight rebels in other parts of the country, and the rebels come back and retake control of a certain particular town, for example. And this kind of to-ing and fro-ing has been going on for a while, and it looks like it's going to continue to take place.
Mm. Well, let's take another break, and I want to put the same question to you, Summer. That's Stephen Starr, again, a journalist. He spent the last 5 years living in Syria, left earlier this year, author of a new book called Revolt in Syria, Eyewitness to the Uprising. Summer Aboud, assistant professor of international studies at Arcadia University. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be talking about what the international community, including the U.S., should and shouldn't do after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Brandywine River Museum supports WHYY and presents tours of Andrew Wyeth's studio. The artist's private retreat is now open for tours. Visitors can see where Wyeth created some of his iconic works of art, learn about their creative process, and see his library, photos, brushes, paints, and much more. Tours take place Tuesdays through Sundays. Details about Andrew Wyeth's studio tours are available online at brandywinemuseum.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Chris Rock. He stars opposite Julie Delpy in the new film comedy 2 Days in New York. He's also producing a new comedy show on the FX network called Totally Biased. Chris Rock on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The woman who was once called the Jackie Kennedy of China faces murder charges there. We'll speak with an Alabama lawyer who worked with her here on a case in this country. Also, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist explains how exploding stars can help us understand the universe. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Stephen Starr and Samer Aboud about the conflict, the crisis in Syria, what's been going on inside the country, its impact on the region. I do want to talk about that as well. And, of course, the various challenges that it poses to the international community. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Samer, let me ask you a more direct question than I put to Stephen Starr. Do you think the international community, including the U.S., should get militarily involved in Syria?
Absolutely not. I think that it actually is involved militarily in Syria, especially the regional states. Stephen alluded to that earlier. Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey are providing funds and weapons to the Free Syrian Army. I should qualify that by saying that they're not the most sophisticated weapons. Of course, there's a report recently that they may have acquired anti-aircraft missiles, and that would certainly be the most advanced and sophisticated weapons. I saw a video the other day where they were using something made from the house, you know, kind of a homemade weapon. So it's not, they're not running around with the highest or the best technology, but they're certainly being supported. We know that Qatar and Saudi Arabia pledged to pay salaries for the Free Syrian Army. I'm not convinced in any way that military intervention would stop the violence in Syria. I think it would actually contribute further to the violence. And as we've seen, the role of the regional actors, United States, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, has actually fueled the violence in Syria. That, of course, is not to excuse the regime or absolve the regime of responsibility for that violence, which, of course, it's primarily responsible. But a military intervention doesn't seem like it could collapse the regime in any meaningful way. The political apparatus, the security apparatus is still strong. And as we've been talking about here, there's still some support, if not large pockets of support, for the regime across the kind of sectarian landscape. And there is that, I think what Stephen referred to as the silent majority, which is neither pro-regime nor pro-opposition, but I would bet most certainly would be anti or against intervention.
Where do you stand, or do you stand someplace on this notion of intervention, Stephen?
I think if you had kind of a large-scale military intervention in the style of Libya, the regime would fall overnight. But obviously the issue then is what happens after that. If the regime falls at a very sudden kind of period of time, there's no central authority. The rebels clearly are fighting for their own interests, and they're very disorganized. The political opposition is still outside the country, and they can't agree basically what way to direct the country. The backdrop to that would be that these whatever countries are involved in a foreign direct military intervention would have to pick up the handle of working on kind of reconstructing the country, and that opens a whole new can of worms, I think, for the international community if that were ever to take place. As Samer is saying, that you know there are countries already partaking in kind of non-direct intervention, I guess, and I think they're smart enough not to go any further. I think it's as much as they can do. I think the American government has been relatively smart in not being more kind of forward about its own contribution to what's happening. We need to be very careful, as Sam was saying also, that lots of people really don't want any kind of foreign intervention at all. I mean, even I was speaking to a Syrian friend in Beirut a couple of days ago, and I asked him, you know, are most Syrians against foreign troops on the ground? And Syria said, absolutely. And I asked them, are most people opposed to American planes kind of flying over the country, bombing military installations. And he said, yeah, also, you know, most people are against that too. So, you know, we need to be very, very careful about the certainly America's role in what's happening in Syria.
Well, but I wonder, and I'll go back to you, Stephen, and I'll hear from you as well, Samer, and then we'll go to our callers. But Kofi Annan essentially gave up trying to negotiate some kind of a peaceful or diplomatic resolution to this conflict. Was he the wrong person? Was he not speaking to the right people? Why do you think that collapsed, Stephen?
You can't try and negotiate with an entity that has no interest in negotiating. And I'm speaking about the regime here. I mean, the regime used this six-point peace plan as a cover for its continued assault on protesters and rebels. It had never any interest in abiding by Kofi Annan's six-point plan. And, you know, as I say, it used it. It said it was agreeing and so on, and publicly, and its state media said that they supported the Kofi Annan plan and that they blamed the rebels for it not succeeding in that. But, you know, at its root, the regime had absolutely no interest whatsoever in abiding by the six-point plan.
You agree, Samer?
Completely. What I think the plan, I mean, if there was any value to the plan at all, it was to try and find a kind of middle ground between the regime and the opposition. As Stephen said, nobody was interested in that. Of course, it served the interests of the foreign powers as well. The Russians could pretend that, you know, they were willing to see the regime go, and the United States could pretend that it was more involved in mediating a solution than it actually was. I think that the death of that plan speaks to a really bigger problem here, and that's that there's a zero-sum game being played by almost everyone in the opposition, the different factions of the opposition, and the regime. It's, you know, we're going to win and you're going to lose game at this point. And I think that the plan at least tried to find or work towards some sort of middle ground and force both of those different actors to abandon that kind of zero-sum thinking about the conflict. And was it a bad idea? Was it a bad plan? Clearly it died. It didn't work. It was kind of probably dead in the water. But at least the idea behind the plan, I think, is where the multiple actors involved here have to get to if there is going to be any sort of resolution to this crisis. I mean, the zero-sum thinking is not helping anybody at all, and it's just kind of, there's inertia and just continued violence and misery, actually.
Let me get Chinua from the University of Pennsylvania to join us. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to find out what your guests think of Russia and China's position in not intervening. It appears the major networks, which I call the elite media here, paints them as being for the regime there. But the question is, can we also see Russia and China's non-intervention policy as trying not to set a precedent where the West goes into a country and support groups that rise or protest against established governments?
It's a good question. And Stephen, let me toss that to you first, and then Summer, I'd like to hear from you as well. How do you see the role of China and Russia?
Yeah, I mean, I think they have their own kind of internal issues and internal reasons for not supporting an international or outside military intervention. And, as your caller was saying, it sets a precedent for minorities inside their own countries, particularly for Russia. I mean, Russia has rather significant influence in Syria. It has a very large base at the port of Tartus on Syria's Mediterranean coast. Tartus is the Russian government's kind of only warm water coastal base. So, you know, for Russia to lose control of what's happening in Syria, or to lose its contacts and links in Syria, it stands to lose something very significant indeed.
What do you think?
So, I mean, there's also the arms contracts. There's heavy Syrian debt, of course, to Russian arms manufacturers that we have to consider. The Russians also just gave the Syrians a $300 million grant or loan. I'm not not exactly sure what the interest rate on it was, but they gave them a substantial amount of money to continue some of the public works projects that were stopped when the League of Arab Sanctions kicked in and a lot of regional investments stopped flowing into the country. Certainly, the Russians have more investments sense, they have more strategic interests in Syria, in the regime, than I would argue that the Chinese do. I think that certainly in the case of China, they do have a much stronger commitment, I think, to this policy of non-intervention. I think there's also perhaps a feeling that the Russians lost out on the reconstruction of Iraq and Libya because they did not participate and they don't want to be left out in Syria. I also think that the Russians don't know what the end game is here. I think they've been kind of cynically supporting the Assad regime and going along with this and hoping that the end of that week would mean either the collapse of the regime or something else to work with. But certainly Russia has more political security and economic interests in Syria than China does.
Let me go back to you, Stephen, and Summer had talked about Iraq, and I wonder just how much the war in Iraq, how that has sort of reshuffled the region or even destabilized the region. I know that many refugees from Iraq ended up in Syria, and now Syria is embroiled in this internal conflict.
Yeah. I mean, one thing we hear very little about in the English language media, at least, is the strength and power of the regime's own media and its own propaganda effort. I mean, for years it's been kind of spouting this idea that Americans are responsible, that the American government is responsible for all the ills that happened in Iraq, which is true to a great extent, I suppose. Every day, for example, people, in Damascus at least, and I guess in Aleppo and in large cities, the propaganda is really quite significant. So people turn on the radios and they hear about all America's bad doings in Iraq. On the, would say, billboards on the streets, there's similar issues of how the regime is strong and that, foreign intervention is bad and look what happened in Iraq and so on. And similarly for newspapers on street stands and kind of state TV, it's the same. So, I mean, and also there's a genuine concern, aside from the regime's attempts to push this idea, there's a genuine concern among people that Iraq could turn out like Syria because it's got such a wide kind of ethnic and sectarian makeup. So for that reason, people are genuinely afraid. And obviously, as I say, the regime backs up or it serves to exploit these fears.
Well, and you have family in Lebanon, you have family in Syria, Samer. So how do you see this?
And I have many friends in Syria that I care very deeply about. Of course, they're all frightened. I think that there's a tremendous amount of anxiety. Of course, all of their family outside were scared for them and were concerned about them and their futures. But I think I was in Lebanon in January of this year. Of course, I didn't go into Syria, but I was in Lebanon. And I think that the best way to describe the feeling of my friends and family there was uncertainty and anxiety. And I remember somebody in my family repeating this line that was supposedly said at many protests, and it was written on walls, the Alawites to the grave and the Christians to Beirut. It kind of rhymes in Arabic when you say it. And I think that was enough to instill a kind of fear and anxiety in them, whether that is, of course, a regime propaganda, as Stephen was alluding to. I mean, it's very sophisticated. It's kind of everywhere. It's an authoritarian state, so that kind of their messages are almost everywhere. I think they're concerned, and there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty about the future.
Let me get, it looks like Jesse from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Jesse, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call here. I'm curious about the role of the United States here, and the U.S. got involved in Iraq from my view for its own political gain and economic gain. And does the U.S. have interest in the outcome here? Do we stand to gain from the overthrow of Assad?
Stephen, can I put that to you first?
It's difficult to say that. But among the Syrian population, there is a pretty serious kind of fear of America's interest in the region and that. Obviously Syria, the Syrian regime has ties to Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon. And I suppose the great international threat, at least we hear, that we hear about, that we're told, is Iran and its possible nuclear weapons. So for the current Syrian regime to fall, this cuts this kind of relationship, I guess, between Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon. The Syrian regime works as a conduit between the two. And, you know, from that point of view, it suits the United States government, at least, for the Syrian regime to fall. But on the other hand, we you know, the Syrian regime falls, but what takes its place, what happens then? Israel shares a border with Syria, and things could get very, very unstable indeed. So I guess the American government maybe is not that really that sure what it wants to take place. But I guess, you know, there are no very positive outcomes at all.
Do you agree with that, Summer?
Definitely. I think, you know, Stephen put it quite well there, that, you know, on the one hand, of course, they want to kind of rupture that relationship between Iran and Hezbollah and Syria's role in there. Of course, Syria's Iran's only major Arab ally, and so a fall in the regime would further isolate the Iranians geopolitically and would give more support to the policies of the Gulf countries, which have been aimed at isolating Iran. On the other hand, the Golan Front has been quiet for 40 years. And
that's between Syria and Israel.
And Syria has done very little other than, has done absolutely nothing, actually, to liberate the Golan from Israeli occupation. And so that front has been quiet for 40 years. And why would the Americans or the Israelis want that to change? I mean, it's to run the risk of the Golan Front being activated, for example, or to run the risk of some sort of militant regime, whether Islamist or not, assuming power and trying to gain legitimacy by playing the liberation card, if you will, because any authority that assumes power immediately after the collapse of this regime will have a legitimacy crisis and will have to look somewhere to find legitimacy, and a talk of liberating Golan might be might be the place, and that would certainly not serve American interests in the region.
Well, we could go on. I appreciate the fact that both of you joined us today on Radio Time. Stephen Starr, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's a journalist. He spent the last 5 years living in Syria, joined us from Ireland, left that country a couple of months ago, author of a new book called Revolt in Syria. Samer Aboud, thank you very much
Thank you so much,
Mike. You're very welcome.
And thank you, Stephen.
Nice to have you here. And he's an assistant professor of international studies at Arcadia University, also a fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.